Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, if there is such a thing as a special podcast, then tonight is one of the more important, one of the more significant podcasts that we do annually, particularly in the lead up to the year. So we're going to try to be as bold and honest, perhaps more importantly, as possible, and just give people an idea as to what we see playing out over the next 5 months or so. Never going to bat 1,000. We will swing, we will miss, but more times than not, historically, we've been pretty decent at doing this.
If we batted 1,000, we would not be talking to y'all. We would just be counting our fat stacks in Vegas.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'd be two time zones over. But anywho,
Mountain time zone, are. Man. And you mentioned bold, much like Louisiana Hot Sauce, our title sponsor for this year's Nolcast. Certainly appreciate having them on board. Pick them up at Publix, Winn-Dixie, whatever grocery store you happen to step into. Eggs, steak, chicken wings. What else you put hot sauce on? There's so many great items.
All types of chicken, baked chicken, chicken. If you want to go the budget friendly route, love to mix kind of a hot sauce marinade with chicken thighs. It's all types of greens, kale. We're really fortunate to have them. Not only can you put it on all types of food, as you mentioned, you can find it in damn near every grocery store in the Southeast. Would love for you guys to engage with us and them on social media. Follow them on social media if you feel comfortable doing that. And we would always appreciate it if you would mention that perhaps you ran across their brand as a byproduct of listening to this podcast. So something that we've been real fortunate to pair with them and are excited to explore that relationship for the next couple months. And Bud, real excited to explore the relationship that is Jimbo Fisher and his players and what the 2016 season ends up looking like.
And Ingram, echo those thoughts. We started off this camp preview series and this football preview series with a series of questions. And we made fun of some other people who may ask questions about fall camp that cannot possibly hope to be answered in fall camp. So we decided to ask only questions that we think could legitimately be answered in fall camp. And we have those five questions that we asked, I think, 8 episodes ago. And we're actually going to answer them for you now that fall camp has ended. Second scrimmage was Wednesday. Jimbo Fisher kind of up and down on that scrimmage. That is typically his pattern. He likes to impress upon his team that he needs more out of them after the second scrimmage, regardless of the year. He pretty much just does this every single year. So the first question, Ingram, I guess we can go back and forth with asking each other these. Will the quarterback decision be an easy one for Jimbo Fisher?
Yeah, I appreciate you giving me a tough one there, Bud. Yeah, that ended up resolving itself and sorting itself out very quickly and ended up, if you want to be positive about it, perhaps gave DeAndre Francois a percentage of snaps with the ones that he would have otherwise never been able to have.
With Sean McGuire going down with injury, by the way, today at the scrimmage, David Visser told me that he was tossing the football around, looked like he was moving around. I mean, for a guy that just had a little procedure on his foot, pretty well. And it is not like Jimbo Fisher to overestimate how long his guys will be out. If anything, he typically underestimates and is optimistic about how quickly they will return. However, Ingram, twice this fall camp now, he has kind of made statements about how long a guy will be out, and it looks like those may have been overestimations on his part, which is very curious. Sean McGuire very well could be back before the 4 to 6 week guesstimate, and Devontae Phillips, they thought would be out for quite a while, mm-hmm. and it turns out he was actually back at practice yesterday. Wednesday, he earned praise from his play at the scrimmage. This is a new Jimbo Fisher. I'm not sure how to deal with this.
Yeah, this would certainly be a curveball with his relationship with the beat if he had begun to perhaps inflate potential injury recover times. I don't really know what to think about it. Was particularly surprised with what we talked about with seeing Sean on the sidelines and seeing him throw the ball. And even, I mean, it's not like he was displaying that incredible 39-inch vertical he has or anything, but even like leaving his feet even if such a mild manner to jump up and catch a ball a couple inches off the ground. That's just that was the real thing that caught my eye, that he would feel comfortable enough to really even just pop up for a ball and be okay with coming down on an ankle. So who knows what to think of that. I'm almost embarrassed that I broke down something like that to the extent that I did. But anytime you have an ankle injury, that's something that's always in the back of your mind, and was really, really surprised by the 30 seconds of a video that I saw of Sean and what he looked like today on the sidelines.
Ingram, that level of hyperanalysis is how you land a national sponsor for a local podcast. That's how we get it done right there. Thanks to Louisiana Hot Sauce for sponsoring us. In fact, I have a Jimbo Fisher quote from Tuesday night that our friend Aria Masudi tweeted out. He was covering the Tallahassee Quarterback Club meeting, and he said, quote, "I won't compare him to a guy that played here a few years ago, but when he plays, you'll like what you see." And also said on the question of protecting Francois with rather limited quarterback depth, quote, "We'll do what we have to do to win. We can't play like that," meaning played scared. "Teams are too good." Seems like he's been pretty pleased with Francois throughout the camp. Now, I know that Francois has had some days that have not been great, but he's also had some days where he's played really well, and he's facing an extremely talented defense day in and day out in practice. Even though they go in against the second team most of the time, they really have put him through the ringer, and it looks like they're confident he's going to be a good player for them. And the people who believed that he was going to win that job, including both of us, I think ultimately, even if McGuire had stayed healthy, I do think it would have been a relatively easy decision for Fisher.
Yeah, that's a good way of bringing this all back together, Bud. I think it would have been an easy decision to an extent. I'm not saying an absolute decision, but you certainly got the feeling that the kind of navigational current was starting to flow towards away from Sean, I'll put it that way. So yeah, DeAndre's your quarterback, certainly appears. And what might have been an easy decision, really the decision process was taken off the table in and of itself with the injury.
So next question here, how will roles in the secondary be divvied up? Will the five starters remain the same, or will they change based on opponent? What is the optimal mix of matching up and chemistry? Will veterans be okay if they only play 200 or 300 snaps as opposed to 800 or 900? Well, I'll take this one here, even though I asked it. I probably should let you ask that. Sorry about that. Most of this question is answerable now, I think. The roles, you are correct. I think Tavares McFadden is going to win this job. For about the past week, he has taken most of the snaps at boundary corner. They are electing to leave Marquez White at field. He's probably a little bit more athletic, agility-wise and quickness-wise, than McFadden is. I like McFadden's top-end speed. The quickness is not quite the same as Marquez, but he's also huge. I mean, you're talking 6'3", 205, 210-ish. At the star spot, which is that nickelback that LaMarcus Joyner played in 2013, that Jalen Ramsey played in 2014, it's been mostly Levante Taylor, but recently with the emergence of Tavares McFadden at the boundary corner spot, Marcus Lewis has actually been taking more of the first team reps there at the star position, something we speculated about in the defensive back preview podcast. So good on us there for sure. That gives Florida State a ton of versatility. If Levante Taylor is your number five cornerback on this team, and I think that's potentially true, man, like, think about this. That is nuts, dude. For the depth they have in this secondary. At safety, you have Derwin James and Trey Marshall, who, from what I've been told, have just been a dominant force against the run in practice and punishing receivers when they are able to hit as well. Everybody knows how great Derwin James is. Trey Marshall looks like he's coming back better than ever after tearing his biceps last year and being out for the second half of the season. The interesting thing here is that Nate Andrews has been out for quite a bit of camp with a calf injury. And in his absence, you wonder is he going to get Wally pipped a little bit? Because A.J. Westbrook has kind of emerged as a bit of a jack of all trades. He's played some stars, like a third string star. I know he's played backup at both safety spots. He's also been playing that money role, which is where Nate Andrews typically plays. The money, of course, the M sound there. M money replaces the Mike linebacker, M Mike. So they have the same coverage responsibilities when they go to that dime defense. A.J. Westbrook looks like a talented guy who maybe not quite as athletic as some of the guys we just mentioned, but could be an important piece of this puzzle as well. And we published on Tomahawk Nation Wednesday morning the defensive back preview, and one of our guys rigged up a sort of choose-your-own-adventure type game where you can pick the secondary combination, and there were 20 legitimate secondary combinations that we put out there that Florida State could use on any given day, 20 combinations of five that we felt weren't absurd. That just speaks to the incredible depth the secondary has. The part of this question, Ingram, that I'm not prepared to answer is, will they change it based on opponent? I think they will some, certainly, both in terms of opponent style, but also in terms of, you know, Levante Taylor is very inexperienced. Marcus Lewis has more experience there. The part I can't answer is, will the veterans be okay if they only play a couple hundred snaps as opposed to the starter snaps? And right now, I don't know how we can answer that. And heck, that might be on us for asking that in a podcast that said we think we could answer this before the season was up or before camp was up.
Well, I will certainly agree with what you said and not fill time by basically regurgitating what you said for the vast majority of the questions. The only comment that I will make is, will the veterans be okay? If you've got a product that you can put in there and play at a level that you think you're comfortable with them taking their time, I'm sorry if you're disappointed in your playing time, but at that point, not much of my concern either. If somebody ends up getting passed up because there's a perhaps a little bit more talented piece or a piece that fits better with what is being asked of this out of the scheme itself, then again, I hate the personal disappointment that a kid in his final year may have, but as far as the ability of the defense to perform, in a way, if feelings are getting hurt, that's almost a positive thing because you think that you've got some of these younger, more raw products in a role that you're comfortable putting them in without perhaps having the experience that other people might be able to fall back on.
I'm right there with you. By the way, Ingram, do you know what McFadden, Lewis, Marshall, James, and White all have in common?
That they're north of 6 feet?
They are 6 foot or taller. Correct, dude. That is a whole lot of length. If you can limit big plays, you're essentially telling people to try and throw over you and contest you in the red zone. And there are very few, if any, secondaries in the country who can legitimately start five guys who deserve to start based on talent, but who also happen to be 6 foot plus in the secondary. That, and the length there, just that cuts down your passing lanes a lot. That creates tip balls, and that gives you a chance to make interceptions that otherwise you might not be able to. It gives you a chance to jam and play more physical. That's going to be hell on offenses when they get in the red zone. And so if you're Florida State, obviously you don't want to let teams drive on you, but at the same time, you got to realize if you don't give up big plays, it's going to be very difficult for people to score on you when they get in the red zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Real hard to score score seven. So be interested to see how they how that might shape a little bit of their philosophy. Certainly never love the term bend but don't break, but you're right. You got to make people earn it, and good luck earning it within the red zone against this defense with a all the height that we talked about and one corner who happens to be 6'3", 208 pounds. That's not going to be any fun for anybody. But let's move to the third question, and that was, who do we see being the potential backup at defensive end?
Well, I think what we said at the time was, I feel really good about the starters, which was Josh Sweat and DeMarcus Walker. Still the case. Josh Sweat appears to have taken a bit of a step forward, and it says he's more comfortable now, his second year removed from that potentially devastating knee injury. DeMarcus Walker continuing to take a leadership role, was already an excellent college football player. But we said we like the backups if they're backups for rotational purposes, if they're in there to spell these guys. We don't really like the backups if they're the backups who are going to have to, like if Sweat or Walker go down and they had to play 60 snaps a game, 70 snaps a game, then we don't like it. Ingram, I think that statement is still mostly true, and we made that before camp. Brian Burns has emerged as a guy in camp who has absolutely smoked even some of Florida State's starting offensive tackles at times with pass rush ability. A guy that just purely looks like he's shot out of a cannon, truly explosive burst off the edge and the ability to bend. I don't think Florida State has had a guy like Brian Burns since Brandon Jenkins. Just really impressive. And I know I said this on the last podcast, so I'm not trying to repeat myself. But he's a true freshman. He's 220 pounds. I love him for 20 snaps a game, 15 snaps a game. If he has to play 60 or 70, he's going to get driven into the ground by more veteran offensive tackles who have been in college strength programs for several years. Keith Bryant, when he's been in there, I've actually heard has shown some improvement, has shown some promising things. Can he spell DeMarcus Walker for a couple snaps a game? Hopefully. If he's your starter, probably in trouble. Again, you got to keep Walker and Sweat healthy. Jacob Pugh, another guy, when he's been healthy, he's been given some credit by Jimbo Fisher. That's potentially a good sign. And then Wally Ime, your JUCO transfer, has played more defensive tackle than defensive end, but I think that he could potentially play some defensive end if you needed him to. But again, is he in the defensive end type shape to where he could actually play 60 or 70 snaps if you had to use him as an actual starter because one of your guys went down? I'm not convinced of that. So I really think that they have some decent backups for rotational purposes, but I'm not sure they have anybody who they're like, yeah, if we lose Sweat, if we lose Walker, the drop-off will be minimal. I think the drop-off would be significant.
Yeah, the drop-off would almost certainly be significant, and it would potentially be a place where you might see us go to more three-man lines. But look, Burns has been a lot of positive talk about him. Completely echo your comments as far as not a guy that you would want to see 60 snaps a game. I'll add, not a guy that you would necessarily even want to see on like consecutive series. He's a guy that you're going to want to rotate, a guy take advantage of situationally, but not somebody that you would want out there after snap, after snap, after snap. Bryant, I was pretty close of almost of putting him in the Chris Kasher category of just permanent, no expectations. The beginning of camp, actually heard some good things about Keith Bryant for the first time since he's been on campus. Haven't heard a whole lot about him since the first part, but that in general, the thought is that he may be trending in a more positive direction than before. Jacob Pugh, some good, some bad. And I don't want to bury a kid after two or three weeks, but just haven't heard a whole lot of things. I'll put it this way. Not so much that the physical tools aren't there, just maybe a little bit of rumblings about if he's fully bought in and fully into the, like how well his transition into the program's gone.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question to ask and something that we're going to have to continue to monitor, man. They're going to need him for some important snaps this year, I think.
But this is probably a kind of a natural halfway point of the podcast, and we will always want to talk about what our friends at Madison Social are doing. Pretty damn innovative, always doing something creative, and they've come up with a pretty unique situation as far as a new stipulation with the type of bag that you can bring into Doak Campbell this year.
Yeah, Florida State, as well as I believe the entire SEC, has adopted the clear bag policy. This is something that the NFL teams did, I think, 2 years ago, if I recall. Because remember when we were at the game in Dallas against Oklahoma State to open the year, everybody had to have a clear bag for that, I think, if I recall, at Cowboys Stadium. So Doak has now adopted that. The reasoning given is essentially one of safety, and so that bag screeners can pretty easily see what's in your bag. They don't have to go through every bag. It's in order to facilitate safety, but also to facilitate people getting into the stadium more quickly. So you don't have to stand in line for 20 or 30 minutes like we know happens at some gates because people tweet their complaints at us as if we have some control over it. However, you can do your part. Thanks to our sponsor, Madison Social, the great guys, Matt and their team over there, the best place for food and drink in Tallahassee, right in the shadow of Doak Campbell Stadium. They have the solution. You can get a pretty fashionable, to the extent that clear bags can be fashionable, a fashionable drawstring clear bag. On one side, it says Madison Social. On the other side, it says there's no place like Doak with a cool cleat logo. Pretty nicely done here. I like it. Just in time for Doak Campbell's new clear bag policy. These bags are stadium compliant. After all, there is no place like Doak. You can order them on madisonsocial.com/clear-doak-bag. That's madisonsocial.com/clear-doak-bag. They're $10. Orders must be in by August 30th in order to receive them for the first game.
Absolutely, and you mentioned that they're required SEC stadiums, Doak Campbell. Trust me, within 18 months, they'll be required everywhere. Worth picking up, worth having at your disposal, and certainly something you'll get a heck of a lot of use at. Bud, fair look back at the third question. We'll go ahead and move to the fourth. Will three or four receivers separate from the pack, or will there be a wide receiver rotation?
We're going to have a rotation. I'm pretty sure, because at times Fisher has praised Travis Rudolph when he's been healthy, which has not been the whole camp. I think he had a hamstring for a while, but he came back on Wednesday. Kermit Whitfield, of course, Bubba Wilson, you know they're still going to play. But you have had some encouraging signs. Number one, as we discussed on the last podcast, the hype for Nyquan Murray, Noonie Murray, is legitimate, at least based on what he did in camp. Now, most guys don't carry over the hype from 7-on-7, especially small guys, but he actually did, and from what I was told, he was probably the best receiver in space in terms of making guys miss after the catch and seems to have a real nice natural feel for the position. So that's a really good sign right there. I know that Auden Tate has been injured through part of camp, but at the same time, when he's been in there, he's actually made some pretty good catches, and I know he took some reps with the first team and the second team. I think that we're going to end up being right that your big receiver to emerge in terms of physically big will be Auden Tate. So that is up to, what, five? I think that you'll still see some attempt to get George Campbell in once he gets healthy. Right now he's battling a groin and seems to always be battling something, which is very discouraging. Ermin Lane took some first-team snaps this spring, which is probably discouraging, but you know, you want the guy to succeed. Obviously, there's no reason to root against him. Who am I? Oh, Devontae Phillips.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, a guy who's slow, to be perfectly honest, but might have the best hands on the team, and in high school was always very good at using his body, even though he's only like 6'1". He's like 6'1", he's over 200 for sure. A physically strong kid who is a tough receiver who will take a hit. Kind of a Willie Halstead type, except not quite as tall, perhaps. Some people compare it to Anquan Boldin. I don't know if he quite has that the
Let's
twitch.
Be careful,
you know,
there.
Yeah, Anquan exactly. Anquan Boldin's a stud.
Yeah. No reason to do an Anquan Boldin filibuster, but an incredible player.
Well, right. And I think that the difference here is they both make tough catches and have extremely strong hands. Quan did it, you know, against extremely elite competition, and so far Phillips has not. The other thing is that even though Q wasn't fast top end speed wise, he certainly had, you know, some twitchiness to him. I don't know that Phillips has that, but you know, if he can become a dependable target, more power to him. Fisher actually praised him for coming back from injury, for running good routes, and for catching the football. Those are all good things. That would mean we're up to six, and heck, Pig Harrison was having a pretty good camp from what I was told before he had I think somebody today reported that he had a death in the family or something like that, or a death of a friend back home. Took a couple days off from camp to go mourn, And, you know, obviously hope he's okay and is in the right place mentally. And you know, that sucks to lose somebody you're close with. But he took some first team reps in the scrimmage today as well. So that's seven, I think. They're still going to rotate at receiver. I don't think there hasn't been a separation that you would want of just three or four guys that Francois can consistently go with. They're probably going to rotate between five and seven guys. All right, I think it's my turn to ask. And Ingram, how many new faces will earn spots on the offensive line? And I don't remember if we counted Rick Leonard for this or not. Do you?
Good question. I mean, that's really the answer to your question. If you count Leonard, then yeah, you will. You'll have one. If not, then no. There's nobody that's necessarily going to emerge. It's not exactly chalk, but it's not. It didn't play out a whole lot differently than maybe we would have thought entering camp.
So, I think Leonard's going to win the job. Obviously, I've heard some good and bad things there. I've heard that he has made some awesome run blocks and just some crushing run blocks, and I've heard that he's made some good pass blocks with some excellent athleticism. But I've also heard that his inexperience, I mean, he just moved from defensive end to offensive line for the spring, so he's played it for about 8 months. I've heard the inexperience really shows as well, and that
maybe pass blocking in particular.
Yeah, which is really kind of a feel thing, man. I mean, run blocking is sort of effort and positioning, but pass blocking effort matters, but less so. It's more about technique and control and feel, and that comes with more reps, and he just hasn't had the reps. So certainly he gets beat in run blocking sometimes in that, you know, we need to see him use more consistent technique and drive guys off the ball because the athleticism is there. But if you have a great athleticism and you don't necessarily use the right technique and you have great effort but not the right technique, you may overstep something, right, which allows a guy to come inside. And that applies to both run and pass blocking. But I think his highs are better in the run game than they are in the pass game. And I think the lows are lower in the pass game than they are in the run game. I'm still very much excited about Rick Leonard. But I think people are taking the excitement from Jimbo Fisher and from some people inside the program and perhaps from us and from others. And I think they're sort of extrapolating that excitement, maybe a little bit too much. I know we had a guy in the comment section the other day of Tomahawk project that Rick Leonard would go pro early, right? And I was thinking, I think a successful season for him would be just hold on to the job, you know? Like, the guy has never played offensive tackle before. He's certainly going to have some growing pains. But I do think that only one new face in the offensive line, assuming that Wilson Bell holds on at right guard, that's indicative of a couple things. Number one, it is not indicative of just status quo, right? There have been legitimate battles at these positions, I think several of them. Now, from guys I talked to who are able to watch the entirety of practice and not just the 10 minutes that the media gets to watch, I don't think Derek Kelly is quite the same player post knee surgery, which kind of leads me to believe that Leonard won this job over Brock Rubel. And that some people thought initially that they moved Kelly back inside to guard because they were so confident in Leonard. The person I spoke with who watched a lot of Derek Kelly at the couple practices he got to attend, he was of the opinion that this was really more about that Kelly may not be able to move well enough to play tackle at a high level anymore, right? So that is not a good sign, but we on the Nolcast try to be as honest as possible. Kelly is certainly competing for that right guard spot, and I think is number two there currently, although he's being pushed by Landon Dickerson, a true freshman freak of a player who we think is going to be a multi-year starter for the Noles and a really good one. And I think it says something too. Man, I think Dickerson really could be a good player for FSU this year. And if he doesn't win that job, that indicates to me just how deep FSU is, especially at the guard spots this year.
I think that's fair. The other place where there's a little bit of just general questioning is really at center. Everly is going to be your center. I'm not suggesting that's not something that we know, but certainly the amount of success that this unit ultimately is going to have is going to be at times a large part of a reflection of how much of a jump he can make from what he was last year. Bud, where do you think we are with that? And I realize he's missed a decent amount of time with injury, so what we can take from fall is limited, but where do you think Eberle is as a player entering the 16 season?
I think he's going to make a significant jump, and I base most of that on nobody truly challenging him there as far as like having a legit shot to overtake him, one. Number two, even though he's still listed at like 296, the guy physically looks noticeably different than he did last year. Like, I think if you pull up a picture of him last year versus this year, he said he put on 10 pounds of muscle, and I think he's one of the guys that you can definitely notice it in, particularly in the lower half. So that should help him anchor a little bit better against some of the bigger noses that he'll play. I think if they were seriously concerned about the center position, they would have tried out more guys at the center position this camp than they did, right? You have Eberle, his backup is Martinez, who has an MCL injury currently and is going to miss a couple weeks. I know I was told via source. I don't know if Florida State's announced that yet at the time of this recording. The backup to him appears to be Andrew Boselli, who is it's a little bit surprising because I thought it was going to be Bavion Johnson, the number one center recruit in the country. But Bavion has apparently had been a little bit behind in terms of snaps and picking up the offense. So, you know, he didn't really enroll. I have to imagine at some point Bavion will pass Boselli, but you got to think, man, that they feel pretty good about Eberle if they're not trying to cross-train another veteran player to come over there and play center.
It's a good point, good way of looking at it. Bud, those were five questions we asked. I am going to throw you a little bit of a curveball and ask you a question from our general position preview, and that is a question I think we can answer, and for the most part, we are pretty optimistic with what we can take away from those five questions. But the general conversation that we had about the backfield and the question we asked was if Florida State can be the best backfield in the country. I think we asked particularly that somebody is going to have to emerge as a real number two threat behind Dalvin Cook, and potentially somebody was probably going to have to be named Jaquez Patrick. That, for whatever reason, doesn't sound like that's taken place at all so far.
It does not. No, Jimbo Fisher has basically avoided questions about Jaquez Patrick this year. Like when he's been asked about him, he has said things like, Jaquez has been okay. He's working, things like that. And having covered Jimbo Fisher for a decade like we have, yeah, that's not a good sign, man. That does not indicate that Jaquez Patrick is coming along like they want him to. And they're still trying to push to get more out of him to get that big back to play like a big back. And we'll see if that happens. On the positive side, he's had a lot of praise for Amir Rasul and for Jonathan Vickers, two players who I was not as high on coming into camp as Jimbo Fisher apparently is. So from a depth perspective, I think Florida State has one of the deepest backfields it has had in quite a while, because you legitimately have five running backs with Cook, Green, Vickers, Patrick, and Rasul. Do you have a true number two who you think would stack up nationally to the likes of a Sony Michel or an Alvin Kamara or Darius Geis or whoever you think the number two is in Oklahoma, either Mixon or Perine? Probably not. So I'm going to have to answer no on this question. I don't think Florida State has a chance to have the best backfield in the country.
Yep. I think that one we can go ahead and put that one to bed. So six questions gives us a decent idea as to how we feel when we really look at what we expect of the 2016 team. And we've gone back and forth with this. We've talked a good bit with each other off air, and it's an interesting situation. But I do want to introduce one point, Bud, before we get there, and that is the idea that certainly when people look back at the 2016 team, it will be based off whether they win the Clemson game, how they look against Ole Miss, and if that's a victory, and whether they're able to continue to beat Miami, Florida, etc. And yeah, that wins and losses is what will always be used as your kind of your anchoring point when judging a team, but there is a little bit of a discussion to be had in kind of comparing the quality of the team and what's been built versus what the team really accomplishes.
I think that's so important to distinguish, Ikram, and to illustrate this example. And the real difference here is, of course, the opponent difficulty, right? Team quality versus team accomplishment. They're not the same thing. Sometimes one year's team can be better than another year's team, but win fewer games than them or win the same number of games. Let me pose this question to you, and I know we did this before the show, so I have a pretty good feeling how this will work out. But I think it's an illustrative example. If you took last year's team and gave them this year's schedule, what do you think their regular season record is? Last year, that team went 10-2.
Yeah, I think they probably lose 4 games in the regular season. I do.
They might lose 5. I mean, I think, okay, 4, I agree. Do you think they would be more likely to lose 3 or to lose 5?
5.
I do, too.
I do. And I don't think that's just playing to the narrative. I really 5 is more likely than 3.
Absolutely. They would be an underdog to this Ole Miss team. They would certainly be an underdog at this Louisville team. They have a decent chance of losing that USF game. I mean, they'd probably still be favored, but not by a ton. That North Carolina game at home.
Last year's team with last year's quarterback play is capable of losing at NC State, North Carolina at home, certainly against Miami, Louisville, obviously, USF, I agree, Ole Miss, Clemson. At that point, we're just starting to be obvious. But, yeah, there's a lot of places that I would feel incredibly uneasy if last year's team was what we were trotting out there.
I don't think there's any question this year's team is going to, unless they have really big injuries, of course. I think we should sort of drop that caveat immediately that this is based on kind of reasonably healthy projection. I think this year's team is going to be a heck of a lot better than last year's teams, man. I mean, we were one of the few people last year who were comfortable immediately throwing out the rebuilding idea. I think it's built. Now, I mean, I don't know if you got the CO or not, but as long as guys stay healthy, I think you will. I think this is going to be a potentially elite college football team, which is a welcome change to last year, which was decidedly not, and to 2014, which was, you know, tough to watch at times because you had this feeling that, man, they're winning, but they're winning so close, and you know you have so much NFL talent on this team, and if they would just play more as a team, and that, I think, shows a good example of why it's very difficult to predict college football sometimes. But, this is a murderous schedule, and I think this is an extremely talented and focused and hungry Florida State team. I can't wait to see what comes of this. You know, exactly. You figure what?
This is the team that you want with this schedule. I don't mean to interrupt.
Oh, hell yeah. Last year's schedule was perfectly timed.
Right.
Swap it. Give this year's team last year's schedule.
Man,
11-1 or 12-0, or are we debating two options basically?
Yeah, I think we're looking at the Clemson game and just staring at the Clemson game for a long time, and people are getting tired of us breaking down, you know, who has a better second team tight end or something like that. Yeah, I think it becomes so hyper focused on that game in particular that it becomes pretty boring pretty quickly.
All right, so what do you think? 6 top 30 teams, probably another 2 or 3 teams on the schedule in the top 50. You know, that's potentially the number one team in the country in Clemson, depending on the poll you look at. The Ole Miss, I think number 11 in some polls. Louisville, who I actually believe is a tougher game than Ole Miss, given where it falls on the calendar and where it's at. This is a tough schedule, man. Vegas has Florida State's over-under number at 10. And they very slightly favor the under, actually, of 10 rather than over. You going to go push, over, under? What are you feeling on that?
Yeah, I hate to say this, although I don't think I'm too much of a danger of being labeled a homer. I feel comfortable with the over there. I do.
I do too, man. Like, people can call us homers. That's fine.
I know people also think we're cynical assholes too. So I think that's probably a good sign.
Yeah, you know what that means? That means we're doing our job right. That's called a sweet spot. If some people think we're homers and some people think we're you know haters, that's somewhere in the middle of that is probably just honest good sports talk, which is what we're trying to provide here. In order, I think over, push, and then under are the most likely options there. But I don't think that I'm going to project them to go undefeated. They're, hell, winning 10 or 11 ball games against this schedule is a really heck of an accomplishment if it's as good as we think it is.
I agree. So, Bud, how do we want to really break this down as far as what we think? I'm a little hesitant to go game by game, do the old traditional, well, we get a win here, but what do you think the best way is to exactly explain how we see this season playing out?
All right, let's answer, what do you think the regular season record is? Do you think they win the ACC? And do you think they make the playoff?
Absolutely. My first question will answer the second question. I think they are 12-1.
Ooh, 12-1. So you think they're gonna win the ACC, and that's certainly in the playoff at that number. I'm pretty sure.
Yes,
barring something crazy. I mean, obviously, I don't necessarily like projecting the ACC championship game, but I think Florida State, if they make it, would be favored over anybody. And man, this is such a binary task that we're being asked to do here. I know you, like, we've discussed this for weeks. Like, who are you going to pick? And I've really gone back and forth in this so many times. I don't think Florida State is much better than Clemson. And I don't think Clemson is much better than Florida State, you know? In fact, if you look at the Vegas numbers right now, what's interesting, you know, Florida State is actually slightly favored over Clemson in the game, but Clemson is actually slightly favored.
Not in the league, right?
Yeah. Now, the reason is Clemson does not have to play a road game at Louisville. They don't have to play at Miami, and they don't have to host, you know, UNC. Florida State has the tougher league schedule this year. It's very difficult for me to pick against a Jameis-like quarterback, and I know people don't like that, but I think Jameis is a heck of a lot better pro prospect than Deshaun Watson, but college is a different game. And I think Deshaun Watson, college-wise, is every bit the quarterback Jameis was because the legs play in college. They matter. And he has to make defenses account for that. You saw what he did to Alabama last year. That said, man, this defense, I think, has a chance to be – I think it has a chance to be the second-best defense Jimbo Fisher's ever had. And if things go right, it could potentially be the best defense they've ever had. Not in Tallahassee, but under Fisher. We're hearing that at times, Matthew Thomas has been the best player on defense.
Yeah, that's now, crazy.
Not all the time, but dude.
If that is even remotely true, Bud, if there's ounces of truth to that, then you have to recalibrate what you think this defense could possibly be to an extent that is impressive, and it gives pretty significant optimism. And I think both of us, and what you can take away so far, is that for us, for the conversations that you and I have historically, this is as close to Homer fanboy as I can remember us talking. And I think a lot of that optimism comes from whenever start to get a little bit shaky, you look at that defense and you look at what that defense can potentially be. And then if you start to factor any type of a Matthew Thomas ingredient into it, then yeah, you're looking at one of the better defensive units in all of college football this year.
I mean, I'm going to pick Florida State to win the division and thus the ACC. Just because of the triple D. Defense, Dalvin, and Doak. The game's at Tallahassee. You got this defense. You got Dalvin Cook. I think 11-1, thank you, sir, is probably the most likely. Ingram, I'm going to throw two curveball questions at you here. All right?
Please.
Number one, to sort of give people a better idea of how close we feel, or perhaps not how not close we feel, what is the percentage chance in your mind that Florida State wins the division?
Good question. I would say that I'd put that somewhere in the low 60s, 62, 63%.
Man, people are always complaining that we're agreeing too much, but I think that's kind of where I am too. I think I would go maybe a little more like high 50s, you know?
Yep.
I really do feel like this is about as coin flip as you can be, and I'm only picking Florida State because it's a home game and because of defense.
Yeah, really, I'll say this real quickly, and this is going to counter what I'm saying. Look, what Clemson brings back on offense is pretty damn incredible. That program has turned its roster into as talented as can be, and I really think that far too often, whether I listen to it, read it, or watch it, that way too many people underestimate what Clemson's defensive unit's going to look like. I mean, the defensive line has the potential to be every bit as good as Florida State's unit, and we both think that they're incredibly talented. Both Florida State and Clemson, that is a team that is wildly, wildly talented, and really at the high water mark of their program historically. So I don't want to sound like I'm discounting Clemson at all. That's what they're doing is on-field production that really is unrivaled in their history. So I don't want to undersell them, and I want to acknowledge what they're doing, but I still think I don't know that I could wrap it up quite as well as the Triple D, but yeah, I think them playing Indo Campbell is really really where my optimism stems from in that particular game.
And that's exactly why I asked that question, you know, because people are like, well, you think they're going to win? Yeah. How confident? Well, I think it's sort of an indicator of confidence there. And the second question I was going to ask, if Florida State does not win the division, what percentage chance would you give them of making the playoff?
Yeah, that's really dictated by where the loss comes from. That could fluctuate wildly depending on who you lose to and where that loss comes from. But I would put it probably in the low 20s, somewhere in that area. If they're not, and they, is this hypothetical that they're not, but they only suffered one loss?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Correct. Because if you had to account for like multiple losses, then it would clearly, you'd have to put it down at like the 5 or 10% range.
Yeah. Let's not be exact. I'd say somewhere around 25%.
I think that's fair. Yeah. I mean, obviously depends on what happens out west, what happens with Notre Dame, what happens in the Big 12. But I think that there's a decent shot that actually happens. I mean, the hype is there. The seed is planted in the minds of the committee.
The seed is planted, and you have so much national media beginning to really acknowledge in a way and probably more concisely than I just did, but just how talented the two rosters are in Clemson and Tallahassee. And it's pretty clear that two of the best five, two of the best six, seven programs in the country are both reside in the ACC Atlantic.
Do you want to go national title pick and Heisman Trophy winner non-Alabama / Deshaun Watson category? And the reason I ask this, folks, is because Ingram and I compared our picks for the national title and for the Heisman Award, and we both had the same answers, Alabama and Deshaun. So we're going to try and make this a little more interesting. Who do you have for your national title pick if you cannot pick Alabama?
Florida State.
Man, I think I'm there with you, dude. Like, if it's got to be somebody other than Florida State or other than Alabama, I think Florida State is just as good a bet, you know, for a number two as anybody is. Although Clemson's right there with them, you know. I think that those are the three best teams in the country, probably.
So it's interesting that both of us are picking Florida State to win the Atlantic and then the conference. But both of us have Deshaun Watson in all likelihood, winning the Heisman. Is that just an acknowledgement as to the idea of the season that we think Clemson has outside of that particular game? Is it an acknowledgement as to his play in the national championship game and how much he and kind of his brand resonates with the national media right now? That is curious that both of us have pegged the media to not do maybe the lazy thing of the number one team in the country, its largest offensive piece being more likely than not to win the Heisman.
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. One, he was already a 4,000, 1,000 kid last year.
Right? The first one of all time. Isn't that correct? Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's the first one to ever do that.
He was probably the best player in the national championship game, right? Despite the fact that he was on the losing side. Clemson returns, like, everybody on offense. They're going to have potentially a historically great offense. You know, but not only that, he's also going to be a top pro prospect. So you're going to have ESPN talking about him all the time. He's not just a product of a system. He's not Taj Boyd. Not only that, he has a really, you know, Heisman-type backstory. You know what I mean? He grew up in a Habitat for Humanity home.
Very much
All of the elements are there. He can lose to Florida State and win the Heisman. But I think also, man, scan this. You know, Stanford, they have Christian McCaffrey, also very possible, but their over-under is 9-3. You know, they're going to give it to a three-loss Stanford team. Stanford would need to overachieve. There's no Alabama player on here. If you look at the odds until you get down to, Calvin Ridley, and I really don't think that's going to happen. You know, Bo Scarborough is, a sophomore for Alabama, the next Derrick Henry type.
Mm-hmm. And yeah.
They're probably not going to give it to him. The next
running back they have.
He was also suspended for part of the year last year, and he's going to be sharing carries. I think it sets up really well for Deshaun Watson to win it, which is why I think we both picked him.
Let me give you part of the reason why I picked it. And Bud, you gave a great answer. You tell me whether or not you agree with me or think I'm being too conspiratorial. I don't know that there's enough national media. A ton of people have Heisman votes who don't really follow college football to the extent that they probably should to be able to vote on an award like that. But there's also a lot of people that hold grudges, and there's a lot of people that make up their minds. And I don't know if there are enough people who would vote for Dalvin Cook almost regardless of the type of season that he has. Now, maybe that's me being a paranoid Florida State fan, but I think there's too many people who think that Florida State, to an extent, is a renegade program, not maybe to what people thought 2 years ago, but that idea still lingers out there. And in particular, that Dalvin Cook somehow was able to get off of punching a girl in the face last year. And that still sits in people's mind. And I think to an extent sits in too many people's mind for him to win a national award like that.
I actually agree with you on that, but I am not going to pick Dalvin Cook as my non-Deshaun selection for this reason, Ingram. I don't think he's going to have the numbers to do it. Florida State plays a really difficult schedule. The best number for Dalvin might be 12-0 or 11-1. Jimbo Fisher is a quarterback at heart. I think if he has a better quarterback than last year in Francois, I think he will throw the football more. I think that Florida State has better running back depth this year, arguably, than it did last year. So I think that they may try to keep Dalvin healthier when possible, as opposed to trying to chase a record. I don't think Dalvin Cook's going to have the numbers that typical Heisman winning running backs in the last, let's say, decade have had. My pick in the non Deshaun Watson category is actually JT Barrett. Cool redemption story. He led that Buckeyes team almost all the way to the national championship until he tore his ACL. They started the wrong guy last year. Ultimately, when he came on and he was made the all-time starter, he played pretty damn well. Really good bowl game. Now the team is his. Can he lead a young Ohio State, you know, super young Ohio State team, blah, blah, blah. Man, that sets up really well, story-wise. And he could have some big numbers.
Yeah, he certainly could. I would go with the McCaffrey kid out of Stanford. I just think that there's going to be a lot of a really friendly national narrative around him. I agree with you. They may not have the record that goes with a Heisman Trophy candidacy, but I think that name is going to carry weight to an extent that people will maybe watch a prospect on the West Coast more than they would otherwise. At the end of the year, he really was one of the better players in all of college football. And if I've got to pick a non-Clemson quarterback, that would be the place where I would go with the Heisman vote. Or the Heisman prediction, excuse me.
You got anything else? I mean, I feel like we're done about an hour or close to it. This is I like your McCaffrey pick, by the way, as long as Stanford can win more games than I think they're going to win. Like, that to me is the only thing that would hold him back. Because I think he'll have some insane numbers when you count stuff like kick and punt returns, which honestly should not be counted the same as rushing yards because they're not the same thing. But a lot of the media kind of conflate the two and just lump it all into this total yardage from scrimmage number. I think he could do it.
But real quickly, Dalvin Cook maybe not having the same production from a rushing standpoint. Do you think there's truth to the line that maybe his rushing stats won't be quite the same, but that his total yardage may be a little bit more similar to last year than perhaps his rushing would, if he's really able to be incorporated more into the passing game, and if Francois is truly a one read, maybe look for him in the flat.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility, and we know that's an area that Dalvin has tried to work on a lot, and we know that's an area that has been considered, at least by the NFL scouts who sit behind us in the press box. Just when you chat with these guys, I'm not going to name them by name. They had kind of indicated that he really doesn't catch the ball that well. So if that's something he's worked on and has been able to improve, then certainly I think it could. Maybe he catches 5-10 more balls.
Fair enough. I think that's a pretty good look back as far as what we think, what we would project moving forward. Almost feel uncomfortable at times with some of the optimism and some of just the glee in general, particularly surrounding the defensive unit. But that's really an honest assessment as far as what we think Florida State has stockpiled on this roster, and particularly what they've stockpiled at the both the front end and the back end of the defense. So certainly going to hope we're right. Would be a hell of a season, a lot of fun. But it will be an interesting season, certainly, and a season that you've really got to be so kind of authentically confident if you're a Florida State fan, just because where the program's positioned, how well it's recruited, and how much talent you can find at damn near every position on this roster.
Well said, man. It's a program built to last, it appears.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Wake up, Mr. West, Mr. West, Mr. Fresh, Mr. By himself, he's so impressed.